Welcome to the Lending Forward podcast, brought to you by Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group. This is your home for real discussions about the mortgage and housing industry. Our hosts are here bringing you firsthand accounts from people at the heart of the business. And we're chatting with professionals from all corners of the industry as they help cultivate transparency around the future of the industry we love. Together, we are lending forward all we know to you. Thanks for joining us for today's episode. Let's dive in. This episode is sponsored by AmeriHome. AmeriHome, a subsidiary of Western Alliance Bank, one of the country's top-performing banking companies, is the largest bank-owned correspondent investor in the country. AmeriHome offers best-in-class service, consistent and competitive pricing, and a full suite of agency, non-agency, government, and specialty products, both delegated and non-delegated, to support their clients' growth.
All right, we're back with another episode of Lending Forward, and today's guest is Dr. Jeremy Porter. He is the Chief Economist and Head of Climate Implications Research at First Street Foundation. I know everybody is having economic forecasts right now. Everybody is talking to, chief economists all over the place to figure out what's going to happen this year. But I'm really excited to have Jeremy on to talk to us a little bit about climate change and the risk that that is associating with our industry. So, Jeremy, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I'm happy to be on and excited to talk about this.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. When I first realized I was interviewing a doctor, I got a little stage fright. I am the opposite of a doctor. but I am very excited to have you on. I'm excited to learn. Because I think there's a lot happening in the world that is impacting our industry. But before we really dig into that, tell us a little bit about First Street.
Yeah. And being a doctor just means you spent way too much time in school. So that would be my answer to that. So I am the chief economist at First Street. I've been at First Street since we started a little over 9 years ago now. So when we started, there were, five of us sitting around a table, really, really interested in understanding how to communicate to people the implications, whether they be social implications, economic implications, whatever they are, of climate risk, and really focused on understanding how people think about these types of implications and how they could affect them personally. So what we did in the very beginning was just talk to regular people. We wanted to understand, whether you were, whatever your political ideology was, whatever your belief system was, we wanted to know what would make you care about weather disasters. And what we heard was that people said that if it impacts them personally and if it impacts their wallet, they would pay attention. And so what we did was we really started to build tools at First Street that focused on property specific, high resolution climate hazard models. We wanted not just to build a big flood zone. We wanted to know, what does your property lot look like when it floods? What happens to, the low parts around your basement when it floods? What happens to the streets out in front of your house when it floods? We wanted to understand at a high resolution, what flooding looked like for specific properties. And then we wanted to start to understand, are there economic implications that are hitting people's pocketbooks, whether they be direct property damages that you can model, or more indirect things like insurance increases associated with the risk and the payouts that insurance companies are making. So we built a series of models. We started out in coastal areas, the East Coast and the Gulf Coast, building out property value models to show people that there's already been a negative impact on property values in those areas from really tidal flooding, persistent nuisance flooding in certain areas. And it wasn't that your property value was decreasing, but it was that your appreciation wasn't growing as fast as other properties. So it really was kind of hidden by the fact that we were in a strong property market and there just wasn't the same amount of returns on certain properties. We got really good feedback from that. So at First Street, we moved into a national flood model. Following that, the national flood model, got picked up by the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, all these outlets were covering it as sort of the first high resolution flood model, got integrated onto realtor.com and other real estate portals. And then ultimately we built out other climate hazards. So now we have a high resolution wildfire model, a wind model, a drought model, a heat model, And all of that now is global also. So we started out US focused. We now have global models for all the climate hazards. And at First Street, our focus remains the same. We want to connect climate risk to financial risk. And so our mission has remained the same over the 10 years. We've, grown in terms of scope, in terms of what we're focusing on, the hazards we're focusing on, the outcomes we're focused on. But really at our core, we're really financial risk.
Yeah. And I mean, you said pocketbooks, and I immediately thought insurance. because my insurance has gone up a ton. And I think, in 2025, we saw huge insurance premiums, grow. Carriers were pulling out of states. I think we had homeowners that were really struggling to stay covered, or we had buyers that had to pull out of the market because they couldn't afford it, couldn't afford the home once the insurance got tacked on. So, I mean, from your perspective, how much of that is being driven by climate hazards?
Yeah, it's interesting because you mentioned insurance, and insurance is the way we all feel
Yeah.
climate risk. It's the tangible way that climate is making its way into the real estate market. And you'll ask people in Texas or in Florida, and you'll say, how are you dealing with the changes in the climate? There's more flooding, there's more hurricanes, and they'll say, hey, I live in Miami. I know what this is gonna supposed to look like. I'll protect my home from it. I'll get through it. I'll rebuild. And then we'll ask them a second question. We'll say, well, how's your insurance doing? They'll say, well, insurance is killing me. And we'll say, well, that's the relationship there is something that people aren't making the connection on a lot of times. So insurance is the way that we feel climate risk. And if you go back and you look at just the increases in insurance from 2000, and you start to tack on things like increases in inflation, increases in construction cost, increases in overhead due to fraud and other things that are driving up costs for insurance companies, there's still a significant amount of that increase is tied directly to climate risk. We are seeing increases in insurance costs tied to climate risk. And if you go back and look over time, there are a couple papers that were published on this that said once the overhead is set and we have overhead on the insurance policy, future increases that you see on that insurance policy are almost one-to-one tied to increases in disaster payouts. So there is this overhead that exists, but the overhead increases at the same rate that something like, your wages might increase. You're starting to see inflation increases on cost. You're seeing inflation increases on wages. But then the delta, where that becomes proportionally more expensive to homeowners, that's something that can be tied back to weather disasters and to climate disasters in particular, and the fact that we're seeing more frequent and more severe weather disasters due to warming sea surface temperatures, warming atmospheric temperatures, the things that drive those types of damages. And the thing that we looked at that was really, really telling to us was if you look at the average American mortgage, you look at the proportion of that average American mortgage that's tied to insurance cost, in the beginning of the century, it was about 5 to 6% of your mortgage was your insurance cost. As of 2024, it was about 12%. So you're
Oh my
seeing
gosh.
that principal's increasing, taxes are increasing, interest is increasing, but proportionally, your insurance is taking up a larger chunk of your average monthly mortgage cost than it was at the beginning of the century. So we're actually feeling that. It's not just something that numerically is growing because inflation's growing. It's something that's proportionally growing faster than the rest of those other drivers of homeowners' cost.
That's wild. And I mean, I want to stick to this for a second because I want to hear if you have trends, but I think one of the other, I guess, climate hazards that has caught my attention is the fact that they're everywhere now. It's not such an isolated event. I mean, you're used to, I shouldn't say used to, but like Florida floods, the coast floods, the mountains shouldn't flood. But it does. And we've seen fires and we've seen all kinds of things happening. What's different now compared to, 5, 10 years ago, in terms of, the frequency or the impact or, just any trends that you guys have seen?
Yeah, I mean, if you go back, I think the best data set that we've seen tracking this was NOAA. NOAA created something called the NOAA Billion-Dollar Disasters tool, and then they would inflation adjust it so you could compare like 1980 to today. Excuse me. And that trend is exponential. If you look at the number of disasters we're seeing that are billion-dollar disasters, and you see the cost of those disasters, flood and storms are the biggest drivers of that increase. So there are windstorms, floods, but also wildfire is there's two ways to look at it. It's still smaller than floods and windstorms, but it's the fastest growing natural hazard from climate, simply because it has such a small denominator to start out with. We're seeing just rapid growth in that as well. And when you look at those trends since 1980s, again, we're seeing kind of an exponential growth in that, a growth that's not linear, is actually growing faster and faster than it was in the past. But we're seeing places that we developed in, 50 years ago that didn't have the type of risks that they have today. We built in some coastal areas because they were safe maybe 50 to 100 years ago. We built in some areas in California or in Colorado because they were far enough away from where we were seeing wildfires maybe 50 years ago. And with the rapid increase in the frequency and the severity, these places that we thought were safe are becoming less safe in a lot of cases. The flip side of that is that the tools that we had in the past to understand those types of risk weren't maybe sophisticated enough or weren't property specific enough to actually tell us that from a probabilistic standpoint, there's 1 in 100 year risk. So if we're only looking back, 40 or 50 years, a 1 in 100 year storm, theoretically, it's not the right way to look at it, but a 1 in 100 year storm theoretically maybe didn't occur 40 or 50 years ago. And we're only looking back a certain time. And now all of a sudden we're seeing, just based on rainfall intensities, this is probably the best metric that I've come across, just based on rainfall intensities, what NOAA calls a 1 in 100 year rainfall rate in some places actually occurs about every 8 years now when you correct for climate adjustments. So in the Ohio Valley, around southern Indiana, the Louisville, Kentucky area, a 1 in 100 year NOAA rainfall rate occurs about every 8 years. In the East Coast, we're seeing it about once every 35 years or so. But that just goes to show you how non-stationary, which is the term that just means that the trend is changing over time, how non-stationary that trend is, and how much we have to account for the warming atmosphere when we think about these types of trends.
That's wild. So, Jeremy, we have data, we have trends, we have tools. We know everything is growing at a rapid pace. We know there's a lot more risk. But we also know that we're all serving homeowners that want that American dream, that want that home. How do we put all this together to better serve our homeowners?
I honestly think that we shouldn't, the term that you hear a lot of times is like blue lining. They'll say, we're like not going to lend in certain areas because of the risk. I don't think that's the approach that we should take. I think the approach that we should take is that people, whether they be lenders or buyers, should go in with their eyes wide open. They should know what the risk looks like. The property value should be calibrated so that they're taking into account the cost of insurance. If there is some overvaluation in some areas, maybe in those areas the values are going to come down a little bit to account for the cost of homeownership of living in the areas. Maybe it's just an area that, if you live in coastal Miami Beach, you're moving there because you have the resources to move to that area. As long as you go in with your eyes wide open, you know what you're buying, you know how to protect yourselves, you know what the risk could be, I think it's perfectly fine. But I think the problem that we saw when we started First Street was that the data didn't exist to give your everyday American who wants to buy a home information and access to that information to make that decision. We believe everybody should be able to make that decision for themselves, but they should have the best information to make that decision. So it's not about really limiting the market and limiting homeowners and home buyers in the real estate space. It really is focused on just having more information to make those decisions.
The more education, the better. We just never thought climate risk was one of those pieces.
Yeah, it's interesting because as we started, one of the first places that, we built a website relatively new. Nobody is just going to naturally go to your website and look at it. So we partnered with Realtor.com was the first group that we partnered with. And there's a lot of working with the folks behind the scenes at Realtor.com. We worked with a lot of realtors. We worked with a lot of folks that, wanted to prove out that this was an actual issue and they could use it. And ultimately what we ended up finding is that as the data got placed on the sites, it was slowly rising in there on their listings of the neighborhood indicators, and things rise on those listings based on how much functionality and interplay they get with people on the site. And so people ultimately ended up using it more than school rankings and more than walkability and more than these things that we oftentimes in the real estate market tie directly to information that's important for us to think about when we buy a home.
That is really interesting. And I saw a stat, and I don't have the actual number in front of me, but I saw something that talked about climate migration, if you will, where, more and more people are relocating due to insurance costs, due to repeated disasters, due to just, all of the things that we're seeing on the news all the time. Are y'all seeing that data as well, or is that just clickbait?
No, we're seeing it, and it's part of so we've run some of our own climate migration models, and when you run them, one of the ways that you would do that is you would go back and you'd create this model that tells you how impactful are schools and jobs and cost of home ownership, or the amenities in the area. What about the disamenities? Being around things that people don't want to be close to, and you weigh all of those things as what they call push and pull factors, things that pull people into a community, things that push people away from a community. And then what we did is we took all of those as amenities and disamenities for individual areas. We tried to model population change historically related to those different patterns in different areas. And then we layered our climate model into those models. And ultimately what the results were that if you control for all of these other factors that we know are important in the housing market, and we just look at the independent effect of climate, we were seeing that independent of those push and pull factors, places that have more severe climate risk and have been exposed to more severe climate events in the past, we're seeing a net negative impact on population growth. And now, if you went back and you layered in all the economic growth, things like Miami, right? There's a ton of climate risk in the area. There's a ton of amenities that pull people into that community. Independent of that, we were seeing a net negative impact from climate, which means it would have grown even faster if it wasn't for the hurricanes in the area, the flooding in the area. And having this data publicly available is to some degree helping to drive some of these trends that we're seeing. Redfin did a study where they ran what's called an A/B test. They had half the people were exposed to the climate data, half the people weren't exposed to it. And what they ultimately found were that the people that were exposed to the climate data systematically searched for lower risk properties after being exposed to the climate data. So
That
people,
makes sense.
when they receive the information, they're making climate informed decisions, just like they're making school quality informed decisions, walkability informed decisions. But the key is that, before 4 or 5 years ago, nobody had this kind of information. So we're just at the very front end of seeing people make climate informed residential decisions.
So I know you said the data is on Redfin, it's on Realtor.com. I believe you said Zillow as well. I mean, where, if I'm a lender or a real estate agent or a buyer, I mean, like, where is the best way for me to get this data? Is it to go to one of those sites and just start looking, or is there another way?
Well, being at First Tree, I'd say the best thing to do is to contact us, and we can figure out a way to set you up with the data. I think it's available on those websites. The other thing that you can do, we have our own website at firststreet.org, where people come there, they can type in a property, and there's a lot more information there that we have that we just can't feed to people on these other sites. But it really is about, thinking about that as part of a larger risk profile. So, people making lending decisions, their job is risk. They think about risk all the time. There are all these other factors of risk and credit risk that they're taking into account. we're not saying that climate is the most important determinant of where people live or where you lend. We're saying it's part of that risk profile. And, taking that data and just figuring out how to integrate it into the larger risk analytics or the credit risk modeling process is really where we think it should sit. It's just another piece of the puzzle that has been shown to be significant, but not the most important thing. There are all these other things that are important also, and should take those things together.
That's awesome. I'm gonna go look up my house when we get off of here for sure.
Yeah.
Well, as we look ahead, this year, next year, the next 5 years, what's the biggest misconception that people still have about climate risk?
Yeah.
And then what's something that they should be paying more attention to? And when I say
Yeah.
they, I really mean me too.
Yeah, for everybody. I think the biggest misconception right now that we still run into is that the tools that we've used in the past, I'm thinking primarily of FEMA zones,
Oh, yeah.
accurately capture flood risk. And I think what we FEMA themselves will tell you that, upwards of nearly 50% of all flood claims come from outside of FEMA zones, which tell you that, they're not tracking all of the different types of flood risk. So when we built our model, we created a coastal model, a river model, and a rainfall model. So we took all of the three sources of flooding, combined them together to create a model. FEMA only captures coastal flood and river, main river channel flooding. So they're not capturing heavy precipitation flooding from rainfall. And as we know, a lot of the flooding that occurs in Asheville, in West Virginia, in sort of more mountainous regions in Texas, what we ended up seeing at the Camp Mystic flooding last year. A lot of that's driven by heavy rainfall and the fact that the climate and the warmer atmosphere, the way that it's really manifesting itself in more disasters through heavy precipitation events. So I think one of the biggest issues, and you can sort of generalize that a little bit more, excuse me. If you say that, the tools that we have today to understand climate risk just aren't accurately modeling climate risk. And what you want to do is work with folks that are building high resolution, peer reviewed. And I say peer reviewed because we end up running all of our models through the academic scientific journals. So we publish all papers on them. People can see the way they're built. They can see all the inputs that go into the model. We post them publicly on our website. We believe it should be a transparent process. You should understand how the models are built. But I think the biggest misconception is that the tools we've been using allow you to understand risk when we know that there are a lot of critical flaws in the way that they were developed.
Well, it's good to hear that we're getting better with time.
Yeah,
For sure.
I think we've done better over the last 5 to 10 years. And outside of First Street, there's just this cottage industry of companies now that are building these types of climate hazard models. Of course, we believe that ours are the best. We champion them that way and that kind of stuff. But I think that there's a lot more attention being played to this, both in the home buyers and home lending space, just in general asset management in the banks, but also you're starting to see it a lot in asset owner, asset manager spaces where people are interested in how do they allocate resources and funds to asset adaptation and ROI associated with adaptation and things of that nature.
Well, let me ask you this, because I know we have most of our listeners are either lenders or mortgage bankers, loan officers, or realtors. If you were to give them one piece of advice, going into 2026 around climate risk and just the economic outlook for 2026, what piece of advice would you give them?
I think the piece of advice I would say would really just be to make sure that you have access to data and data that you trust, because as we've seen in the historic trends, this is only going to increase. We're seeing increases in frequency, we're seeing increases in severity, and we're seeing increases in damages to properties. And so as those things are increasing, if we tie those to the future climate projections. I'm an economist and demographer by training. We have climate scientists here at First Street. Our chief science officer came over from NOAA, where he was the chief data
Oh.
officer. And he tells us if over the next 30 years, we're pretty much baked in. There's not much change that's going to happen over the next 30 years. You'll hear a lot of people talking about carbon in the atmosphere and electric vehicles and things of that nature. Even if we made all the changes in the world to stop using oil and gas, we would still, for the next 30 years, have the same trajectory. So I think that anything that happens after that happens post 30 years. So we're pretty locked in. We know what it's going to look like. We know there's going to be more damages. I think the key piece of advice would be have data at your fingertips to integrate into your process to take into account. And again, it's not the most important piece of information, but it should be a piece of information that you integrate into your process.
That makes sense. I appreciate you for sharing that. Well, we are coming up on time, and I can't let you leave without asking you our signature question, which is how are you planning on lending it forward in 2026?
I've been thinking about this question, and I think that the key way it's sort of built into my position here at First Street. I'm an academic by training, so I joined First Street after being a professor for many, many years. And one of the things that I really feel very strongly about is democratizing data, making sure people have access to information, making sure that people have access to modeling processes so they can make their own decisions. I think the key for me here at First Street is going to be to continue to build economic implications models, put out reports that offer insights into what we're seeing in the market, and without being too much of a pest, asking people to integrate them into their processes and to think about these types of models.
That's awesome. Well, I appreciate people like you that are pushing out the data and trying to make it more, accessible to all of us. As a homeowner, I would appreciate, seeing what the climate risk looks for my house, especially as we look to, move at some point into new places. But I do appreciate it. I appreciate you coming on the podcast, and I hope you have a wonderful 2026.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again for tuning into today's episode of the Lending Forward podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our channel, follow us on Instagram at Lending Forward, on YouTube and LinkedIn. Catch us every other Thursday with a brand new episode and go lend something forward today. Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group, LLC, NMLS number 72043, NMLSconsumerAccess.org is an equal opportunity lender and employer. Located at 600 Lynn Haven Parkway, Suite 100, Virginia Beach, Virginia 23452.